Okay, good morning, everyone. And good to see everyone again. Welcome to all those on Zoom. It's debatable. Because in offices, you don't really have to, but it depends on the crowd. I don't know. Okay. We'll have to consult expert halachic advice. Okay, let's. All right.
We're protected here.
You have to ask Gladys. She's not here anymore.
Okay, we better start. So I just want to start with it's week 2 of the new series, King Solomon's Advice. The Wisdom of King Solomon, advice given 3,000 years ago, that's still relevant today. And we're focusing on the book of Mishle, the book of Proverbs. So just to give a quick overview from last week, just so we refresh ourselves. So we talked about Solomon, who's known as the wisest of all men. He became king when he was very young, and he was granted one request from God. And he chose to ask God not for anything material, or any success, or power, or fame, or longevity. He chose to ask God for a wise heart. And Hashem gave him, as we described last week, Lev Chacham V'Navon, a wise and understanding heart. Chachma and Bina, Chacham V'Navon, with the heart. So he explained the term, which he finds itself elsewhere in the Chumash, Chachmei Lei, when they constructed the Mishkan, that God appointed Chachmei Lei, people who are wise at heart, and we talked about what this means, and the essence of what we discussed is that the greatness of the mind is its weakness. In other words, being detached, being objective, which is its greatness, from outside, standing back. But the problem is that that's its weakness because it doesn't become me. It doesn't internalize. Therefore, after we process wisdom in the mind, we need it to be expressed in the heart. That's what we explained last week, right? So wisdom actually has to be expressed through the heart. Things like empathy have to come into the place, sensitivity to others, understanding the audience, understanding the situation, which is what they call today EQ, but as we spent last year, is an old biblical concept. We talked about the two terms of Chacham V'Navon, Chochmah and Bina. So wisdom is, the idea of Chochmah is you surrender to a truth of a concept. You're willing to surrender to something that wasn't part of your thinking pattern. But then, Bina means you have to then make it yours. You have to understand it, it's to become yours, which is the pathway to it becoming expressed in the heart. So therefore, that becomes Chacham V'Navon. Okay. So that's the essence of what we spoke about last week. Now, each week we're going to take a few different verses in Proverbs, in Mishle, and have a look at them. As I said, King Solomon wrote 3 books. Shir HaShirim, Song of Song, which is very, very difficult. Kohelet, which also has wonderful lessons, but I can't pronounce the English translation, so we'll stick with Mishle. What's it called? Ecclesiastics. There we are. Ecclesiastics. Yeah, I got it.
It's a whole word, isn't it?
No, it's terrible. I don't know what it means. Even. I don't know what it means. Anyway.
It means Kohelet.
Correct, exactly. Okay. So what I want to look at today is a few sentences from the book of Proverbs, the book of Mishle. I'm skipping around. I'm not going from chapter 1 necessarily. And I'm looking today at a few sentences from chapter 10. Incidentally, Proverbs has 31 chapters, so we could keep going for a while. But anyway, so it's chapter 10. Just by introduction, the essence of what we're going to discuss, I want to just give a bit of an introduction to this. So I think the essence of today is the power of silence. And the reason that we come into that is the following. We know that one of the fundamentals of effective living, and quoted in the Talmud and the Rambam, and many, many sources talk about this, the idea of assessing a situation. It's called measured behavior or well-thought-out behavior. And particularly well-thought-out and measured speech, right? This generally fits in with an idea which we discussed once, I think a year or two ago. No, it was one of the lockdowns, I don't know which one. We did it with Dr. Pelkowitz's book. We discussed this whole idea of Metinut and Zrizut, and if you remember, Metinut means calmness, which is kind of a mindful way of living, thinking about things, pausing, assessing, analyzing, as I say in Yiddish, nishki altahet, in other words, not rushing, right? On the other hand, we have this concept of zrizut, which means alacrity, which is doing things quickly, getting it done, not procrastinating. And of course, they're not contradictory at all. Metinut means we are where we are, we measure our next step, we think about things before we do them, but then we get them done. In other words, we don't kratz, as I say in Yiddish, we don't procrastinate. Now that's very, very much connected with the concept of speech as well, and the essence of really what we're going to talk about today, which is the value of silence. A topic which we've touched upon a number of times, but today we're going to take it from a different angle from the book of Mishlei. So, we're going to talk a lot about the value of what silence does for a person, and the value of being silent. Now, obviously, we need to clarify this, because obviously, as we've spoken about hundreds of times, we are communicators. That's our essence. Our essence is speech, right? Our essence is to become a communicator, to be able to connect through communication. However, it's interesting that in Judaism, as much as speech plays a role in communication, so does silence, right? Silence has a very, very prominent place in Jewish thinking and has tremendous value on a number of levels. So I'll just give you a couple of examples. One of the values of silence, of course, is preparing for speech. So it's the pause, it's the space to stay away as much as possible from impulsive speech, right? Impulsive speech is ineffective. Impulsive speech is often destructive, divisive, and so on and so forth, because impulsive speech is just what's on our mind or on our heart. It doesn't take into account what's going on around us, often driven from ego, driven from the me. Therefore, silence, often, as we've spoken about many times, is often the pause before the speech. It's time to process, it's a time to think, it's a time to prepare what I should say, what I shouldn't say, and so on and so forth, right? Silence has a prominent place as being an alternative to uncertain speech. So if we're not sure what to say, we get cautioned in the Talmud very often and in different sources, silence is always the safest. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't aim to speak, because we do need to. And sometimes always choosing the safer option is not effective either. It might be safer, but you don't get anywhere. So obviously, we need to learn how to communicate. But often when we are in doubt, should I say this or not? As we'll see later, silence is often the safest way of doing it. Then, of course, we find a concept of silence in its own right, not only as preparation to speech. We find it as an experience in its own right. And we find that often silence is a form of experience, we'll see in a moment, that is higher and actually more reflective and more meditative and holier even than the concept of speech, right? It sometimes means that through silence we can access a deeper experience, a more inward experience, more in touch with ourselves, more in touch with higher concepts, more in touch with spirituality, with godliness. Often the medium to get there is through the concept of silence. So in other words, now silence not only vis-a-vis speech, it's also a concept in its own to be used sometimes as an experience on its own right. Now, just to clarify, of course, what does silence mean, right? The definition of silence is not the absence of speaking, right? That's a very, very important thing to understand. Yeah. Silence doesn't mean you're not speaking. That's not what silence means. In other words, to put it a bit differently, just because you're not saying anything, it doesn't mean you're experiencing true silence. That means you being quiet. Different. You're not being silent, you're being quiet. Okay? Because silence is a different form of experience. In other words, absence of speech is doing nothing. Silence is an experience in its own right. It'll become clearer later, hopefully. Right? It might be the space that's created to be able to think, right? In other words, if someone asks you a question, you're just silent, but you're not using the time to think or to prepare for what you're going to say, that's not silence. That's just doing nothing. That's just being quiet. Or it's time, as I said before, to be more spiritual, to be more meditative. So silence is an experience, important thing to understand. Or sometimes silence is an exercise in self-control in its own right, as we'll speak about later. And that's a worthwhile exercise, something we all need to exercise once in a while. So just to clarify this a little bit, Rabbi Sacks, before we get to the verses of Mishlei, Rabbi Sacks has a very, very beautiful article on this where he talks about the reason that the Torah was given in a desert, right? The giving of the Torah, of course, is the, as we've said many times, the ultimate experience of Jewish identity, It's when we became a nation. It's when we, our whole Jewishness stems from Mount Sinai. And the Torah was given in a desert. Many, many reasons are given for this. One of the reasons he says is an interesting take is that the desert is a place of silence. Place of silence. There's, I think we spoke about this. We actually had a discussion on this once, I think, where it's a place of silence where there's aren't other things happening. Yeah. That's that, because I quoted this once before, right? But I want to just take a different part of the article now. So he says it's a place where there's nothing to distract you. There's no noise to muffle the sounds, although there could be a lot of noise. But the concept of desert represents the concept of silence. And he quotes from Eliyahu HaNavi, who went to the place where the Torah was given. He went to the spot of Mount Sinai, and he writes in the Tanakh, it says, Eliyahu HaNavi heard the voice of God, but it was a cold mamadaka, very soft and silent voice. Right? Now, he says, of course, Judaism is not always about silence. I'll just read you a very cute paragraph. It says, many years ago, the British television produced a documentary series called The Long Search on the world's greatest religions. When it came to Judaism, the presenter, Ronald Iyer, seemed to be surprised by its blooming, buzzing confusion, especially the loud, argumentative voices in the Bet Midrash, the house of study, which is true. If you go into a yeshiva, it doesn't look like a library at all. It's very, very noisy. In fact, if you're not used to it, it's very hard to concentrate. Remarking on this to Elie Wiesel, he asked, is there such a thing as silence in Judaism? Wiesel replied, Judaism is full of silences, but we just don't talk about them. So he goes on to say, of course, Judaism is a very verbal language, right? Not to take away from the concept of communication. We know everything is through words. We pray to God through words. We connect through words. We connect through communication. And as we've talked about many times, words create, words communicate. Our relationships are shaped for better or for worse through words, right? But and therefore, he says, sometimes we find silence in a very negative way. You know, Elie Wiesel himself writes about this, the prohibition of being silent in the face of evil, the prohibition of being silent so the next generation doesn't remember, and so on and so forth. We find silence as a symbol of pain. When Aharon, the high priest, Moses' brother, lost his two sons, Vayidom Aharon, he kept silent. Although there was a good part to that silence as well, but it was an expression of pain. In the book of Job, we find about his friends go to visit him, but they don't say anything because they can see that he's in pain, right? So silence often sort of has that negative connotation because it represents the inability to speak because of pain, because of frustration, because of whatever it is, right? However, as Rabbi Sacks points out, and this is the point we were making before, but not all silence is bad, right? In the book of Tehillim, we read a verse that says, Lecha dumia, which means to you silence is praise, we say to God. If we are truly in awe at the greatness of God, the vastness of the universe, and the almost infinite extent of time, our deepest emotions will indeed lie too deep for words. Right? So there's a silent communication where sometimes we're so connected, we're so drawn to God, we're so yearning. In Kabbalah, it's called Re'uta de Libas, like a yearning of the heart, which is so deep it cannot even be expressed in words. We have a similar thing in Hasidic tradition with the nigun. Right? Although nigun is verbal, it's not. I mean, it's not silence in the sense that it comes out. It's noisy, but it's musical. But the deepest nigunim, especially in the Chabad tradition, are the ones without words. Those are the ones. Why? Because just the tune, and the slow ones, the yearning ones, particularly because they represent something that cannot be spoken. Right? We lead in Pirkei Avot. The famous Pirkei Avot, where it says that one of the great rabbis says that I've grown up all amongst the sages and I've never ever found anything better than the concept of silence, right? We find that in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, all the rituals were done by the Kohanim, right? The priests. And then you also had the Leviim, the Levites. The Levites sang while the service was going on, but the Kohanim didn't sing. Because we are instructed, the Kohanim had to specifically do their service in silence. Because that was representative of the holiness of what they were doing. So the place for song was there, but that was done by the Levites. But the Kohanim themselves, they didn't sing. Right? And of course, we know that throughout the ages, the Kabbalists or some Hasidic sects engaged in many, many meditative practices, which were done specifically through silence and breast love, for example, particularly, but other Kabbalists as well, various types of meditations, which were very often the concept of silence, right? We have the idea of pre-davening. Now, it's interesting, when you pray, you need to enunciate the words. But there's a great practice of called hitbonanut, which is a form of meditation done before davening, before prayer, to prepare for prayer, to get in the mode, to get into connect, which is done specifically through silence. So that's just the concept of the idea that we find silence having a prominent place. Now, of course, again, like I say, of course, that doesn't mean that we are not communicators. Our essence is communication, and the goal of life is communication. The goal of connection, the goal of relationships, the goal of connecting to God, all through words. But the words can only be effective if you also find the ability to be silent. It's interesting, later on in a few minutes, I'm going to quote from a book that I discovered. I didn't know it existed. It's quite fascinating. I was preparing for the shiur, and I came across, I'll give away the secret how I came across to it. Right? I have a computer program at home called Otzara Chachma, all in Hebrew, but it's thousands and thousands and thousands of books, hundreds of thousands. It's like a whole library. It's amazing. And it's got a search engine, and you can search different ways. So there's a Gemara, there's a famous Talmud, Talmudic piece that says something about silence, which I've quoted before. It says that a word is worth one coin, whereas silence is worth two, right? And there's many interpretations of that sentence. And I did a search. I wanted to see what the commentaries are on that particular page of the Talmud. You can do it. You can search different ways, and one of the ways you can search is you can put in a page of the Talmud, and it'll give you all the books that comment on that page. It's fascinating, right? So I'm scrolling through. I mean, there's like hundreds and hundreds. I wasn't going to go through all of them, but I stumbled across this book, which was written in the 15th century. It's called Mifchar HaPninim. It was written by a great sage. They're not quite sure which great sage. There's a dispute of which one it was. It seems like it was a Sephardi sage. And what it is, it's quotes, one-liners, fantastic stuff. One-liners, powerful one-liners that he says he received from wise people or philosophers, all to do with personal growth and personal development. Like, it's like crazy. I didn't know about this before, but it's like an amazing book. Anyway, I will be quoting from it down again for sure. So he has a whole, it's 50 chapters, I think. Each chapter is called a sha'ar, like a gate. The gate of this, the gate of that. So he has a whole chapter called Sha'ar Hashtika, the gate of silence, right? Which was a great resource for this topic. And I read it. It's all one-liners, but there's a lot of commentary on the page. This is the one with commentaries. It's very nice commentaries. They quote that piece of the Talmud. That's how I came to it. So I read that chapter, and I think to myself, when you finish reading this chapter, you actually just want to not talk anymore. Like, he made such a good case for silence that, you know, where's the talking, right? Which obviously didn't sit well with me, because we know that that's not true. We need to talk, and we need to learn how to speak, and communication is the essence of the human being. And that's when I realized, just scrolling down a bit, that the next chapter is called Shar HaDibur, the chapter of speech. And it fits very well what I'm saying, because, and he starts it, he says, after everything I said about silence, but you need to know how to talk too, right? Because that, at the end of the day, is the goal. The goal is talking. Now, so let's start now the discussion by quoting some of the verses that I wanted to quote from chapter 10 in Proverbs. So I'm just going to quote about three or four verses, and I'm just going to explain them a bit, each one, before we talk about a sort of a broader thing. So King Solomon says the following. He says, the wise conceal knowledge, but the mouth of a fool brings ruin near. Right? The wise conceal knowledge, but the mouth of a fool brings ruin near. What does it mean, the wise conceals knowledge? So Rabbi Hirsch explains on this verse. He says, wise people know a lot of stuff. They know a lot of things, right? And they foresee things. They can see things that are going to happen. They understand what's happening. But they don't. They always think before they divulge. They always think before they're going to reveal what they know. Because that is the power of speech. That's why we need the power of silence. The wise, because it sounds almost like a funny verse, the wise conceal knowledge. It doesn't mean information, right, or teachings. Not at all. We know that you're not allowed to withhold teachings. There's a concept in the Talmud called Monea Bar. If someone has the ability to teach others and doesn't, sometimes out of false humility or claims he doesn't know, is not sure if the lecture or the shiur will go well, but he has knowledge which he doesn't reveal or doesn't share with others, that's a terrible thing. The Talmud talks about terrible consequences for that, right? Terrible punishments. Because we have a responsibility to each other, and if we know something, if we know teachings, if we can teach someone something, we should. The previous Lubavitcher Rebbe used to say that if someone is learning the Aleph Beit, and all he knows is an Aleph, he doesn't even learn the Bet yet, he has a responsibility to teach someone who doesn't know even an Aleph the Aleph, right? Okay, so that's not what it means. When it says the wise conceal knowledge, he's talking about people who know information and yet choose through self-discipline, through self-control, through restraint, not to reveal it to everyone. Because sometimes revealing everything you know is destructive. There's a famous little line in Yiddish that says, "Mutarnish zogen aligen." You're not allowed to say a lie. "Ama medafnish alamol zogen de ganze emes." You don't always have to share the entire truth, right? And this is on all sorts of levels, right? We live in a society today where people just mouth off whatever they know. Sometimes you meet someone in an elevator, you strike up a conversation, which is a good thing. There's research actually that it brings a physical benefit. But sometimes it's like over the top. You meet someone you hardly ever know, and in 5 minutes you know the entire life story with all their traumas, right? you know who's in their life that's causing them pain. You know their problems with their mother, with their grandfather, with their sister-in-law, with their cousin. In 10 minutes, right? It's a sign of a fool, essentially, right? It's not helpful. It's not necessary. They don't know who they're talking to. If all they know, they can be talking to someone who's very close to one of the people they're talking about. There's no research done, no preparation, nothing. Right? That's why it means we're talking about the wise. And we've said that again, the wise means the wise of the heart. Right? And that's why the commentaries point out, Rabbeinu Yonah says that this verse points out the danger, I'm reading to you, of associating with people lacking in wisdom. They say whatever comes to their mind in the conversation is likely to include tale-bearing, derogatory information, bad advice, slander, which can harm other people, essentially, right? So that's what King Solomon means. He says, the wise conceal knowledge. Not everything we know we have to say, even if we are tempted to say it, right? And we're not even talking about gossip. Might not even be technical lashon hara. That's not the point. The point is, not everything we know has to be said. It has to be beneficial, right? And that's sometimes the outcome of great ruin and great divisiveness or destruction and so on. By the way, all this we're going to talk about today is very easy to talk about. It's much harder to implement, obviously, right? That's why we talk about it. This is very difficult. It's not the default position of most human beings, I think. Except for the
practice, you really have to be aware of.
Yeah, correct. It takes a lot of consciousness, a lot of awareness. And I think what it does, and I'm going to say this in a few moments, and then we're going to quote from that book who has that chapter on silence. It also comes through, just like general fitness comes by going to the gym once a day for half an hour, right? Or walking for half an hour. It some of us just need to practice the art of holding back as an exercise in its own right to make it easier for us to implement it. You know what I'm saying? Then he continues and he says, again, and here we see the balance. It doesn't mean that you never talk. Because the next verse that I'm going to quote for you from King Solomon, brilliant in its own right, says the following. That doesn't mean that you don't reveal things when you need to reveal them. And he says, "Mechaseh sinah," someone who conceals hatred, which seems like a good idea, right? Someone who conceals hatred has false lips. But he who utters slander is a fool. So what is he saying? Say like this. We don't reveal information when it's not necessary. We don't just talk and mouth ourselves off when it's not necessary. But we also don't become false and manipulative. And we don't act with falsehood to other people. We don't flatter people when we can't stand them inside. Talk respectfully, right? Mm-hmm. We don't make out as if we love someone when we actually hate them. Mm-hmm. Why? As we've spoken about many times, there's a verse in the Torah that says you're not allowed to harbor hate in your heart. If you really hate someone and you can't get rid of it on your own, you actually have an obligation not to hide it. Now, what does that mean? So that's the next sentence. He says, but if you slander, you're a fool. It depends how you say it. Again, as we've discussed many times, this is very difficult. It's that difficult conversation that we've discussed many, many times, right? Because a flatterer, as Rashi says, has false lips and conceals hatred in his heart. Right? One who harbors hatred in his heart, refusing to leave it, causes yet another transgression, as we know. So therefore, if there's a real problem with someone, and we can't deal with it on our own, to make as if nothing's wrong and just to continue as normal and in fact make as if you're the person's friend when you're not, is problematic. To the point where King Solomon says, concealing the hatred is falsehood. It's false lips. On the other hand, you have to really make sure how you talk about it. The Vilna Gaon says that a person always has to speak sparingly with others, particularly in this concept, right? If a person has wronged you, if you speak sweetly to the person, that's false lips. But if you scream and insult and offend and slander to others, right? You know how sometimes people say, well, you know, I can't hold it inside. So what do? They tell the whole world except for the person that they're supposed to be talking to, right? Like if someone's got a problem with me, don't tell 10,000 people. I once heard from someone, he said, if you think I got it right, tell the world. If you think I got it wrong, tell me. Right? Talk to me. Explain to me. Now, it's not always well received. We always have a fear and a scare how it's going to be. How it's going to be received. It might be rejected. The person might be offended even more. It takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of trial and error. And it's a risk. It's a risk, obviously. But it requires that art of silence, but not to remain silent. That's exactly what King Solomon is talking about. Silence at the end of the day, particularly when silence is not, it's always an experience in its own, but particularly when it's there to serve and to create effective speech, remaining silent for too long obviously is not going to work. Therefore, we need to be able to speak to the person, but with great restraint, sparingly, choosing our words carefully, choosing the timing carefully, and making sure that the words are wise, wise not just from the head, but wise from the heart. That we're not getting the person offside, we're not just mouthing off what we want to say, we're not just projecting ourselves, we're not just exploding, we're not just venting, we're not just being impulsive, but we're actually speaking words that will rectify the situation, bring us closer together, being beneficial for the other person to know where I'm holding or what I'm feeling, so that we, with the goal of reconnecting stronger, right? That takes a lot of practice. I just saw a story this morning I'm going to share with you. It's a story which is amazing on many levels, but just a little bit, it brings out this point about knowing what to say and like holding back, you know, not necessarily just exploding or taking things personally and things like that. So there was a photographer. I remember him well. It was a photographer. He lived in Israel, and he would come every year for the Chagim, Rosh Hashanah and Kippur Sukkot, to America to be Bala Lubavitcher Rebbe. I remember the Chagim I spent there. I remember him well. He walked around a whole month with a camera and a video camera, except for the actual Shabbat and the actual Chag. Right? And he had a very close relationship with the Rebbe. The Rebbe didn't always like everyone in his face taking pictures, but he had special permission for some reason. And the Rebbe had a very warm relationship with him. Often joked with him. It was very, very interesting. Anyway, he took thousands of pictures. So one time in Israel, it was in 1976, in Bar-Ilan University, in a particular section there, a place called Bet Sokolov, he did an exhibition of all these pictures. He was a very good photographer. He did a beautiful exhibition of the Rebbe and his court, I guess. And the exhibition had a visitor book for people to leave their name that they were there and to make comments and so on. And everyone commented it was a very beautiful exhibition, the whole thing. So one journalist left the following comment. He said, "With all due respect to the superb photography, the subject you have chosen is extremely clerical and it takes us back to the primitive darkness of the Middle Ages." Okay, understood. So this Mr. Friedman, Rabbi Friedman, I'm not sure what he was, he says the story like that. He says during his next visit, he told the Rebbe about the exhibition and he gave the Rebbe the visitor book. The Rebbe flips through it, and he was a very fast reader. The Rebbe used to pick up things very quickly. And he sees that comment, right? So he said the following, listen to this. He said the following to Mr. Friedman. He said two things. First thing he said is, Please compliment the journalism on his strength of character. It takes fortitude to differ from all other responses. And then he says, but please also tell him that not everything in the Middle Ages was dark. Right? That's thought out speech. I mean, that was the Rebbe, but not everyone does this all the time, but that's thought out speech. It's not about me. If I'm upset, I don't think that I was upset, but even if you are upset, what's the point? If you're really upset with someone, you do have to talk about it, but obviously it wasn't that important thing. What was more important was his mission. His mission was, how can we affect another Jew? How can we bring someone else closer? How can we maybe inspire someone? Now, so it's an amazing thing, because what he said was, and if the Rebbe said it, he meant it. He always saw the potential in something, even potential in something negative, right? He meant it, that it was he saw the good in that strength of character, which obviously can be channeled. So that's how he started off. Had he started off like giving back a myth, not everything in the Middle Ages was dark, so it would just be a debate. You said the Middle Ages was good, I said it wasn't good. He started off by saying, I recognize your strength. You have strength of character, right? But understand, not everything in the Dark Ages is, not everything in the Middle Ages is dark, which of course, by the way, is a fundamental Jewish principle. We don't believe everything in previous times are dark. Our modern world is not so great as we claim to be. It has a lot of benefits. We've got technology, after the Industrial Revolution and so on and so forth. But where does all our wisdom come from? Where does our discussion come from today? Where does all of Jewish knowledge comes from? From those dark ages, right, so to speak. That's where it comes from. They were much cleverer than we were. So that was the point. Not anything that the Middle Ages was dark, but the way he said it and that sort of ability to speak with wisdom, which comes through thought, through pausing, through restraint, sort of very much in that, right? Now, so that's what King Solomon says. I just want to sort of clarify this a bit with a Kabbalistic idea. Why this is so necessary? Why that silence plays such an important role? And why silence is so necessary, particularly before speaking? So we know that not everything, right? You know, I started by saying that silence is often a loftier experience than speech, right? I'll give you an example. God created the world with speech, right? As we know. On Shabbat, he rested. What does it mean, Shabbat, he rested? So the Kabbalists tell us, on Shabbat, he doesn't create the same way. Now, how does the world exist? The Baal Shem Tov taught us the principle that the world cannot exist unless God keeps on renewing every moment the creation. So it says, of course he creates the world through Shabbat, it just means he creates it differently. That during the week, the medium of creation is through the concept of speech, whatever that means with God. On Shabbat, the world becomes elevated to a level of thought, machshava, essentially the concept of silence, right? Speech means I'm interacting with something else. The world on Shabbat becomes so connected with God that it's within him, so it's a more of a silent experience. Now, this is not the time to go into exactly what that means, but this is the idea, so much so that it says in the Talmud that actually Shabbat is a time for inward thinking. Obviously, we're allowed to speak, but we need to limit our speech. We're not supposed to speak about mundane things. It's a time for reflection. It's a time of silence. Now, if I asked you the question, what is holier, Shabbat or Tuesday? Obviously, the answer is Shabbat, right? But if I ask you the question, in which day lies the purpose of creation? The answer is Tuesday. Or Wednesday, or Thursday, or the weekday. Why? Because the purpose of creation was not a Shabbat experience. The purpose of creation was to create something that's mundane, that's weekday-like, and invite God into that experience. Right? So not something that is more powerful or holier doesn't mean it's the purpose. Right? You cannot get to the purpose unless you go through that holiness first. In other words, we cannot fulfill what we need to fulfill during the week unless we have a Shabbat. Shabbat resets the button. Shabbat reminds us of who we are. Shabbat sends us more inward. Shabbat is an opportunity to absorb holiness. And with that holiness, we charge and we have the ammunition then to go into the week and then to inspire the week. Okay. Same thing is with speech and silence. Silence actually is more powerful than speech. That's why meditation is holier. And reflectiveness and thinking inwards. It's a holier form. It's a holier, it's a higher and more lofty and more spiritual experience than speaking. right? That's why, you know, in Eastern practices, they have these retreats that they send you to a place where you have to be silent for a whole week. I personally think it's against the sugar, but right? Yeah. Right. No, the problem is because they see silence. They see silence as an end in itself. Silence is not an end in itself. It doesn't mean it's not greater, by the way. You see? When a person goes through a silent experience, it's very powerful. Where be it self-control, be it thought and reflection, be it meditation, be it hitbonanud, whatever it might be, it's a very powerful experience. But it's not the purpose. The purpose is to connect to others. The purpose is to put things in communication. The purpose is to be able to speak, right? But you cannot speak effectively unless you prepare through silence, whatever silence is. And this plays out in something I once shared with you in the whole story of Yaakov and his two wives, Rachel and Leah, right? We all know the famous story that Yaakov wanted to marry Rachel. On the last minute, Lavan switched her and he ended up marrying Leah first. And he was upset, so his father-in-law said, no problem, you can marry Rachel too next week. And that's what he ended up doing. He first married Leah, then married Rachel, and those were his two wives. Who was the main wife, we are told? Who is what we call the Akeret Habayit, the crown of the home, so to speak? Rachel remained that way. And Leah felt it, which is why she was compensated with having children quickly, and she felt, God saw her uneasiness, right? Whatever that means. But there's a Kabbalistic take on the whole story of Rachel and Leah. Because Kabbalah tells us that Rachel and Leah represent two experiences. Leah is the experience of thought and silence, more inward. Rachel is the experience of communication, malchut, dibur, communication. Right? So the Kabbalah narrative of this whole experience is the following. Yaakov arrives. Yaakov is going to be the father of the Jewish nation. He's going to be one to establish everything about who we are. And he knows what's the purpose. The purpose is Rachel. The purpose is Dibur. The purpose is speech. The purpose is to reveal, communicate, broadcast God in the world. Broadcast to other people. Share with other people. Connect to other people. Symbolizing also connected to the whole world in its entirety. It's the whole concept of Dibur. So he goes for Rachel. He wants to marry Rachel. God says, yeah, you're right. But you forgot one important thing. You can't marry Rachel before you go through Leah. Leah has to come first. Leah might not be the ultimate destination, but Leah must be there first. You need that experience of thought. You need that experience of silence before you can get to the concept of Rachel. And that's why it plays out the way it does. Right? Just to put it a bit differently, we've often talked about the 10 powers of the soul, right? The 10 powers of the soul. So we have the 3 intellectual, the 6 emotions, and then malchut. What's malchut? Malchut is that the receiving, the one that receives from all the others and processes it. It's the feminine power we've talked about many times, and processes it and then communicates it to the outside. Very, very powerful force. But in Kabbalah we are told that malchus is synonymous with the concept of dibur, the concept of speech, concept of words. Because what is words? Words doesn't have anything to it. Words is only the content you put into it. Yet it has the power to do with that content where the content cannot reach itself, right? It's the incredible, powerful force of communicating something with greater depth and clarity because it comes through the power of words. That's why the essence of the human being is the soul of life, is the words. Dibur, speech, malchut has a very, very powerful origin. But it cannot operate unless it receives from all the others. That's why effective speech, going back to what we spoke about last week, effective speech means it's got to have in it, it's got to take time to process intelligence, wisdom, empathy, sensitivity, sometimes kindness, sometimes harshness, firmness, sometimes the combination of both. When the power of communication is finished, processing everything else from the other 9 powers of the soul, then it's ready to produce, then it's ready to give birth to something incredibly powerful. But only when it does that first. If malchus, if words just impulsively come out of the person without processing everything that's there from the other 9 powers of the soul, it's just a powerful force that has no content to it and is very destructive. That's why the power to think, right? Which is why King Solomon continues over and he says, abundance of words, with abundance of words, offense will not be lacking. But one who restrains his lips is wise. Rabbeinu Yonah says on that, a great commentator, he says, a person who speaks too much does not allow himself ample opportunity to properly scrutinize and to weigh his words before they are spoken. Therefore, he should restrain his lips from speaking until he has scrutinized what he's planning to say. In other words, that concept. So the concept, yes, of course the purpose is to speak and communicate ultimately. But it needs that space, it needs that silence, it needs that thought in order to make sure it comes out okay. It needs that time to process the chokhmah, the binah, the chesed, the gevura, all into a proper sequence and a proper place and a proper system in order then to be able to communicate it properly. So, as we said before, it's not an easy thing. This is not easy at all. By default, most people don't have this ability, or don't have it well at least, right? But it takes practice, right? It takes practice, and it's something we continuously have to practice. One of the ways to practice is to focus a little bit on silence as an end in itself, not permanently, but temporarily, and to understand the greatness of silence and to exercise silence often so that we learn the ability of holding back, right? We learn the ability of holding back. So to do this, let me just quote for you. I said I discovered that book with the great one-liners, this 15th century sefer, and I'll just quote for you some of the lines. He says they're beautiful lines. He always starts his sentence by saying, Amar ha-chacham, the wise said. I'm not sure exactly who he's quoting, people that he learned from, whatever the wise said. And the first quote he says is, this is in chapter 32, the Shar Ashtika, the gate of silence. He says, when I speak, I might regret. When I don't speak, I will never regret. Right? Now, again, it has to be contextualized, obviously. In other words, should I say this? Shouldn't I say this? You're safe. If you don't say it, you're safe, so be careful. Then he says a beautiful line. He says, Ve'amar, and the wise one said, he says, when I speak words, the words control me. When I don't speak, I control it. In other words, what he's saying is a very powerful thing. Words, we know, are incredibly powerful. Incredibly powerful. As we know, we've spoken about many times, right? Until I say them, I'm in control. After I say them, it controls what's going to happen to me. Right? Otherwise, you can't take something back. Once you've said it, you've said it. As we know. We often say things that we regret, like, why was I so stupid? Why did I have to say that, right? But it's too late. Once I've said it, it takes me over. It goes to wherever it gets forwarded on, to use a modern WhatsApp language, and it gets forwarded on. People take it in the wrong way. People misunderstand it. People do whatever they want with it. It comes back to bite us. When I don't speak, I'm in control. When I do speak, it controls me. So therefore, treasure the power of silence. Another one he says is silence in relation to commitment. You know, sometimes impulsive speech is not about, it's not only about aggression or being divisive. It's also about commitment. You know, people that like just quickly commit to lots of things, right? So he says the following thing. He says, the laziness of silence is much better than the laziness of speech. Mm-hmm. It's a bit cryptic, as the commentary's point does like this. He says, if you don't get something done, but you didn't say you were going to do it, no one's going to criticize you that much. But if you said you were going to do it 10 times and you didn't end up doing it, that causes that damages your reputation, right? So, better get things done before you commit some. You know, like, just, as Pirkei Avot says, Emor ma'at va'aseh harbe, say little and do a lot. Right? Another powerful line, just to bring out the concept of silence, he says, Im titcharet pamachat, he says, if you regret one time for silence, you will regret two times for speech. In other words, silence is not perfect either. And even if you do regret your silence sometimes, believe me, you'll regret much more. A person will end up regretting much more what he or she said than the times they were silent. Right? And as he says that the silence of a person is far better than the spoken word spoken at the wrong time. He says another interesting thing. He says also in terms of influence, people often think that to be persuasive, not persuasive in a bad way, maybe persuasive in a good way, and to inspire others, to assume leadership, to create authority, this is a good lesson for teachers, you know this, right? That He says, "Berov hashtika hamora." Fear, not fear in the bad sense, but like authority, respect from others, is gained much more by being silent. Right? It's an amazing thing, actually. And it's interesting that if you say less, if you babble on, I'm not, this is, I mean, you see this a lot in teaching, but teachers that just instruct like 10 instructions a minute, and always screaming and shouting and instructing and preaching, no one hears them anymore, right? No one even notices them sometimes. The ones who say a little, say very little. Now, when I say very little, again, I don't mean, see, it's different to teaching, right? You know, I was learning this, and I was thinking, I'll share this with you, because I just heard a beautiful story about him also. Just one time to time, I talk about my father-in-law, who was really a giant of a person. I'm just thinking about it because his yahrzeit actually is this coming Monday. It's fifth yahrzeit. He was a person of he was a person who was very wise, extremely wise. And because of that, he never said something unless he needed to say it. Mm-hmm. Now, again, that doesn't mean he wasn't a person of many words. I'm not talking about being a cold person. That's not a good thing necessarily, right? But it means saying things that are thought about, saying things that are measured, and saying things that are beneficial. So when it came to teaching, when it came to sharing ideas, whew, it was like a fountain, right? He spoke and spoke and spoke and spoke. But when he commented on something, it was always very, very measured. And he was a person in the yeshiva that I learned, because I was a student of his before I met his daughter, right? I was a student. I remember learning his yeshiva, and there was a faculty. I mean, the faculty were all nice people, but there was unquestionable that he had the most authority. Partly because he said the least. When he walked into the room, he just knew he was there. Like, he was like this towering person, but not because he spoke a lot, because he didn't speak a lot. And it would be very, I think before he said, it always wasn't about, it was always clever. Like whenever he said something, it was always like wise. And that's how he got through to people. He never, see, this is also the thing, right? Because this is the difference. Speaking impulsively means I speak what's on my mind. I'm not speaking, as we've said many times, I'm not speaking to be effective. I'm not speaking to create an outcome, an effective outcome, a positive outcome. I'm not speaking to create a better relationship. I'm just speaking for my own ego. That's really what it means, right? And therefore, like, I mean, we're all guilty of this, but like, you know, you're having a debate with someone, right? And you see, like, you're not getting through at all. So you become more and more passionate. You scream more and more, and we shout more and more. And we never get anywhere. Right? We shout because sometimes it's a good thing, because we're passionate about it. And we really think, it might even be legitimate, but we're not getting there. Right? I remember witnessing him once having an argument with someone. It wasn't an argument in anything. It was actually even just how to understand and interpret a certain passage. Another person was very, very passionate. And he listens, he's quiet, doesn't react, the person goes on and on. Lets the person finish, completely finish. Like real silence, right? Finish completely. And then just one sentence, he says, what about what it says on the other page? Like just very calmly. Thought out, very calmly, wastefully finishes, restraint, you know, that kind of thing, right? So that's, I'll tell you another story with him in a minute if we have time.
He probably actually listened.
Yeah, he was an incredible listener. Because also, there's another concept which is spoken about more in Pirkei Avot. I'll just share with you something that the Gaon of Vilna says. And he says like this. First of all, just go back to that book. His last quote I wanted to tell you. He says, when you don't have ethical guidance, like you're not sure what to do, you're in an environment you don't know who to ask, the best thing is just to be quiet. If you're someone you can ask and discuss, good. If not, be quiet. It's always the safest option. And a similar but even more important thing that is taught by the Vilna Gaon in Pirkei Avot, it says that a person should be a tail to a lion and not be a head of a fox. Right? So what does that mean? You know, it's very interesting, right? Like if there's a... What does it mean a tail to a lion? So the Vilna Gaon explains it like this. And this is something... You know, certain people who are very bad at silence... like extremely bad at silence, always need to be heard, right? There can be people in the room that are a lot wiser than them, a lot cleverer than them, a lot more experienced than them. But they always have to give their two cents because it's important that they are heard. That's what King Solomon says, that the abundant words coming from a fool, right? The Vilna Gaon says, if you're around great people, be a tail to the lion. Learn from other people. Silence is an opportunity to listen. It's an opportunity to learn, right? It's an opportunity to learn from others. If there's someone there that's greater than you, that's more experienced than you, more wise than you, instead of making sure that you're mouthing off and broadcasting to people who want to listen to you, you have an opportunity, and being ahead of people who are lower than you, be a tail to the lion. Go and learn from people that are more experienced, right? So I guess the bottom line from this is the following, that we need, speech is of course the purpose. Speech brings connection. Like again, this paragraph was about how good it is, and the best alternative is even to be quiet. The next paragraph is about the importance of speech. But in order to get to effective speech, we need this chapter. We need those verses from King Solomon. We need to learn the art of restraint, the art of not mouthing off, thinking about what we're going to say. And maybe we do that just by taking the words of that 15th century sage and actually just practicing silence. If we're a little bit unsure, let's practice the art of holding back. Very hard, because when you're in a group, sometimes people are saying things that you think are outrageously stupid, right? And you know that you're 100% right, if you are or you're not, could be both, could be true. You always have that temptation to launch in, right? It's tempting. We all suffer from this. But it's that art of restraint that is so necessary, that is so difficult, but so necessary, right? And that what makes a wise person. We have 2 minutes. Just to say, just another beautiful story that someone sent my wife's family about a story in yeshiva. There was one time a younger guy working in the same yeshiva. I was already married to him, but this is the same yeshiva that my father-in-law was there. And he, I'm just saying this in honor of his upcoming yard site. So he used to really listen to the students, and he would care about them. He was really strict. It wasn't like he wasn't, you know. If something went wrong, he was not okay with it. But he was clever and held back. So there was a boy in yeshiva. There was a young man who worked in yeshiva. He was in charge of like the boys and sort of called a mashgiach. In other words, if they're behaving properly, if they've got the right things, if they're coming on time, that kind of thing. So there's one boy in yeshiva who was caught by this guy, by this young man, doing something, you know, really inappropriate. I don't know. Looking at something, researching, something that was inappropriate for the yeshiva. And this guy knows that if he tells some of the other members, not that they were great people, but if he tells some of the other members, that's probably the consequences are going to be very, very upset. They might blow up at this guy, and it could be, it'll ruin this guy's chance of remaining in the yeshiva, right? So the decided he's going to go talk to my father-in-law. So he went to talk to him, and he listened, didn't react. He said, okay, let's see what happens. Let's wait, don't do anything. Meantime, this boy, and my father-in-law didn't go talk to that boy, he left it with this young guy. This boy got really scared that he was going to be kicked out of yeshiva. He like this rabbi, I didn't tell him what he's going to do about it. He just said, you know, it was very, very wrong, and you know, I have to think what to do. So for the next week, he wasn't such a top student. For the next week, he really put in an amazing effort. He like came to everything on time. He listened to the shiurim. He was putting in amazing effort. After a week, he gets called into my father-in-law's office. And he gets scared. He thinks, does Rabbi Tzvi will know about this? Maybe now I'm finished, right? Comes to my father-in-law's office. My father-in-law doesn't tell him that he knows. Again, you see, that's like, don't say things you don't need to say. And he says, I'm just calling in because I just wanted to tell you that, you know, when we accepted you into yeshiva in the beginning, there was obviously a question mark, because it was a question whether this person was qualified to come into the yeshiva. When we accepted you because we heard you have an amazing potential. And I've always believed that, but you said, no, but you know what you've done in the last week? I didn't realize how great the potential actually was. He comes out, and this other rabbi was desperate to know what my father-in-law told him. He says, you just went to Rabbi Tzibul, just by the way, what did he tell you? He says, Rabbi Tzibul is so naive. He has no idea what happened. And it was just amazing. He just thinks I'm fantastic, and it was really, really good. And he turned around. And he never ever found out that my father-in-law did it, because he knew the whole story. You don't need to say what you don't need to say, and we need to know the art of restraint. He had it. I don't know if he worked in it or he had it naturally, But he had it, and because that ability to hold back and not to jump in always, and to think before you speak, and to make sure that the words are wise, made him an incredible. I mean, he was also very academically clever, but that's something else. But he made him a wise person, as we said, like we spoke about last one, Lev Chacham Menavon, a wise heart. So that's the message out of these few verses, the importance of practicing the concept of silence in its own right, but also obviously to result in effective communication. So next few weeks we'll take more lessons from the book of Proverbs. All right.